Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, Tracy McClure takes us inside the Synod Hall and speaks to the Apostolic Vicar in the Arabian Peninsula, Bishop Paul Hinder. Stepping inside the Sistine Chapel to admire a dancing Sibyl from Libya, signed Michelangelo. When Mark Anthony, the Emperor of the Eastern World, gave Cleopatra 200,000 scrolls for her library in Alexandria. And marking the month of the Rosary on a musical note by bringing you a comment on the fourth joyful mystery. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. As you probably know, from the 10th of October, the Vatican has been buzzing with news from the Middle East because of the Synod of Bishops focusing on this area of the world currently taking place there. Tracy McClure has been following events in the Synod Hall. She told me how women religious and lay people this week addressed the Assembly of Bishops and spoke to me of a particular participant, the Apostolic Vicar in the Arabian Peninsula, Bishop Paul Hinder. Let's listen to what he told her.
For me, it was very important that not only that their presence, but also what they said, especially some of the short interventions of the lay, of the auditors and also the specialists in the groups, were for me essential. They have brought something which has not been seen sufficiently by the bishops, maybe because of our professional deformation sometimes too. I thought it even this morning in our group, working group, or the English working group, it's very important to listen to them. And we have heard it was a priest, but I think he spoke mainly also in the name of the others to listen more to the people, what they are suffering, what they are expecting. And there is sometimes the risk that we, bishops, we are so concerned about the structural questions, about the question of the jurisdiction of the sacramental service, of our obligations, that we do not always sufficiently realize what are the needs and expectations of the people. To give you an example, what have we spoken a lot about the right and the importance of the different church traditions and the patrimonium of the different sui juris churches. A very important issue. But going back, for example, to my country, and I'm not the only one, the people, they are not so much interested about the details of the church interest. They have to struggle how to maintain their faith, how to work together if they are Melkites or Latins or Syro Malabar or Maronite and so on. I remember I had a meeting a few months back and we were speaking about the synod. There were Arabic-speaking Christians of different traditions. They asked me, Bishop, you have to fight. You have to fight because we know that our bishops, they would like to establish for each again their own structures. We can't have that here in the Gulf. But when I am telling that, of course they don't believe, my colleagues. But sometimes it's worth it to listen a little bit to the people because they have their own life experiences in the daily struggle of their faith. They work together. They go to the same mass. One Sunday it might be a Maronite mass, the other Sunday a Melkite mass, another Sunday the Latin mass, according to the possibilities they have. They don't bother if they are originally too much belonging to this other one. And that is not so easy for me. It's a little bit easier because I'm coming from outside and I'm also myself a migrant. But for many well-established bearers of church responsibility, it's not so easy to understand that. And they are expecting from me also that I'm clearly establishing the different structures for the different churches. It's simply not possible. It's physically not possible for the time being. We don't have the money, we don't have the space, we don't have the time to research, not the personnel. So we have to adjust with this precarious situation and to do the best we can. And then at the end we have a compromise, and I think it's not even the worst. I could quote people from India and even from Lebanon who told me we have equally good, if not better, pastoral care here in the Gulf than I had at home. So that means that besides our limits, and we have really limits, the work on the whole of my priests and of the many lay people, thousands who are working with us, is not the worst one. And I am in admiration, coming back to the role of the lay people. Our church in the Gulf, we could close it up without the thousands and the whole area of men and women who are sharing our responsibility in the catechism, in the organization of the daily and weekly ongoing of the church activities. It's possible only with the help of so many committed people. It's wonderful. I've never seen that in any part of the world as I have seen it in the Gulf, and I'm very grateful for that. Only the Filipino population in my vicariate may go beyond 2 millions. Without speaking about the hundred thousands of Indians and. So it's a very complicated work because the few worship places we have are not sufficient for the real needs we have. We have 7 parishes in the UAE, 1 big in Abu Dhabi, and the biggest one in Dubai, St. Mary's in the city, in Jebel Ali, which belongs to Dubai Emirate, Sharjah, Fujairah, Ras Al Khaimah, and 1 in the oasis city of Abu Dhabi in Al Ain. We have 4 parishes in Oman, 2 in the capital of Muscat, and 1 in the south in Salalah, and another 1 in Suhar. Then in the 2 smaller states, Qatar and Bahrain, we have 1 parish in each one. I'm about to open a second one in Bahrain. Then in Yemen, we have 4 small mini parishes connected also to the reality of the missionaries of charity, Mother Teresa sisters who are working in 4 places for the mentally and physically handicapped people with 4 homes. And that gives us the title to have also priests, because it was Blessed Teresa herself who made it a condition when the president asked her to send sisters, only if I can guarantee that they have spiritual assistance. And that makes it possible that we have 4 priests in Yemen. And then we have the huge reality of Saudi Arabia, which is a particular situation. Difficult also to speak about that. We have in the whole vicariate of Arabia around 60 priests coming from different nations and languages. About 2/3 of them are Capuchins, because the whole area is by the Congregation for the Evangelization of the Peoples given in trust, entrusted to the Capuchin order. The Capuchins are coming mainly from India, from the different provinces and language states, like Kerala, of course, Goa, Karnataka, Tamil Nadu, Mumbai, Maharashtra, and then from North India. We have 4 Capuchins from Lebanon, looking especially after the Arab-speaking communities in the big cities we have. Then some Filipinos, some Americans, I am a Swiss, and my secretary too is a Swiss, and we have still 2 Italians who were the founder of the mission in Arabia, but they had now to share it with the whole order, and anyway, they have no more the people to send to Arabia nowadays. Yeah, and then we have some other priests, also few incarnated, most of them got their vocation working in the past in the countries of the peninsula. and some others are coming in a contract, a kind of fidei donum with bishops or religious congregations. Most of them are working in the UAE, where we have a relatively good structure and also relatively much freedom. Then the others are working in the other countries. 8 priests are working only in Qatar, in this huge parish of Our Lady of the Rosary, or in Bahrain. They are gathered in one house because that is one of the conditions we have. Priests have to live in the official compound given to the church, and all our official activities have to be done there. If we want to have activities outside of the church compound, normally we have to ask the permission, unless there is a particular situation where we have simply to act for the good of the souls as well as we can, but then we do it at our own risk. Normally, we try to adjust with the laws of the country. In Dubai, from Friday morning to Sunday evening, of course, it depends also on the weekend, but there must be around 40,000 people coming to Mass. On the Sunday alone, they may be, or Friday, let's say, 25,000.
You were listening there to the Apostolic Vicar in the Arabian Peninsula, Bishop Paul Hinder, speaking to Tracy McClure. Our thanks go to both of them. By the way, the Synod of Bishops for the Middle East ends on Sunday, 24th of October, with a closing Mass presided over by Pope Benedict XVI. And now, moving on in the programme, why not step into the Sistine Chapel for a moment to look up at Michelangelo's depiction of a dancing Sibyl from Libya. That's with our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis.
One of the most fascinating figures, and perhaps one of the closest to the scene of the Last Judgment, is the Libyan Sibyl. Mm-hmm. A Sibyl from Libya, who's one of the most beautiful, perhaps. She looks like she's dancing.
Yes, in fact. And she has reason to, because of the message that she's foretelling. She represents the African continent. You can see this wonderful S pose that she's in. You can almost draw an S on the whole figure, starting from her head, hips, going over to her knee, going to her toes, and coming back to her other foot. So you just ding, ding, ding. It's a lovely, lovely curving S figure. She's just caught in a moment where she has thrown off her cloak and thrown it on the table behind her. And on the table, you can see that she has this massive book that she's lifting the pages, holding on very strongly on one side of her hand. You see on the right-hand side there. And on the left, she's running her fingers between the pages. And again, like most of the other Sibyls, she has this semi-turban on her hair. And her hair is also prepared in such a way that it looks like the way they used to prepare women for marriages, you know, with the pleated hair.
And she's blonde, despite representing Africa.
Yes, in fact, very blonde. And again, you see the colour of the turban she has also is a violet colour, which is very similar to the colour in the underrobe that she's wearing. You can see it's a sort of a diaphanous colour robe that she has covering all her legs. And this colour is a little bit like tinted marble. So Michelangelo, again, able to prepare some of his colours and portray some of his colours almost as if they were marble. This one maybe here in particular, you really feel the sense of marble. Again, there's another white robe near, which again relates to the faith. And then on top of that, then she has this magnificent dress robe, which has a blue border, blue silvery border, and again with another robe underneath. So it's a very diaphanous, it's a very luxurious robe.
With even a bit of transparency there.
Yes, in fact, but again, always down towards the feet and the knees. You can see also really, again, this capacity of Michelangelo to be able to paint luxurious shot silk. You really see it here because they're all different types. You have a darker green with some gold on it, and then you have a paler green with a light gold. Then you have another part which looks like red, rusty colour. And then you have the yellowy gold garment that's sort of flickering. And on the inside, it looks like it's a pink, a sort of pale orangey, sort of pinky peach colour almost. It's strange. It's difficult to describe it. And then the figures, the two little male figures beside her, they're both seated and one is covered in a robe of white and holding a closed scroll under arm, and the other one is dressed again in this sort of dark purpley colour. But everything here is happening to sort of give action. She looks like she's about to step off this, because also he has put, apart from the normal step that he put underneath his thrones here, there's a little block, you can see. So she's obviously sitting on one little block, or the throne, and the material is covering the throne. Then her foot is resting on a little gold-type block, you could say. And she's looking down towards the altar. She's concentrating on what's happening on the altar. You just get the feeling that she's just going to leave the book there, just put it down and lightly step off and come down and participate in the ceremonies at the altar.
Meanwhile, let's stay in this part of the world by speaking of libraries and books. That's with our popular lover of all things Latin, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Watch change of pace and tone.
Well, there's something you've got to tell me today. I've always wondered, did the Romans like reading? Did they treasure books? Did the emperors try and create libraries? And what kind of a record do we have of all this? Do we have any knowledge of all this at all?
It's very interesting. I'm reading a book right now about libraries in the ancient world. Casson, Lionel Casson, one of the most interesting books in the world. And he says, we simply don't have half of the stuff we don't know. It's a very small book. Extremely interesting. Private libraries here in Rome, that's just where I am now. And what the emperors tried to do and build public libraries and all that. But he said, we half of the information we simply don't have. Sad to say.
How'd you say library in...
Biblioteca.
Biblioteca? So we've lost...
Well, a lot of the details and how they got books and certain... Alexandria, we know the whole history. Pergamon, we know the history of some of these big libraries that, you know, the Eastern emperors or monarchs had. And they're all described. Who was in charge for 50 years, 20 years, 40 years, etc., etc. But personal libraries, how people got books, and Cicero says, copy this book. Where do they get a copy of this thing? At a bookseller, downtown, someone else? We just don't know a lot of things.
They weren't books in print. They were...
Oh, yeah, written out.
Written out.
After a while, they had booksellers. You could go down to the forum and buy books. But for ages, hundreds of years, they didn't have anything like that. You'd have to go to some educated man and say, do you have this author, Homer, or someone in your library? The scrolls, you know, and then they would look and yes, no. But it's very interesting. We know so many things, but in a certain sense, we don't know anything.
We know nothing about our written history, you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. Of course, Cicero said that himself.
We lost track of
He said our history, Roman history, is very weak, which is true, because it was half destroyed by the Gauls in 390. So all that preceded 390 BC was practically destroyed.
Destroyed by fire?
Well, the destruction of Rome by the Gauls who came down and... Psst. So it's we just don't know anymore. It's the end of it. To think that Mark Antony, gave Cleopatra, you know, Queen of Egypt, before the end came, Actium in 31. He, as the Eastern monarch, gave Cleopatra as a gift 200,000 scrolls from the library of Pergamum up in Asia Minor for her library in Alexandria, which was the gem of the world.
How would you say that?
What?
Mark Antony gave her...
Ducenta milia codicum.
Codicum is a word for book.
Codex, you know.
Codex.
Codex, you know, the scrolls, or voluminum. A Cleopatra donavit. Nescio ut munus ut beneficium quadam as a gift. And we don't know whatever happened to those, all those books and everything, all that stuff is gone. In Alexandria, there were 490,000 scrolls in the Library of Alexandria. Whole history of the world, omnia perierunt, all these things have been lost somewhere. By the 200s, they were all this stuff was lost.
They perished, probably. I mean, they're not hidden anywhere.
Yeah, no, given away or burned.
There was nothing like an itinerant library or anything like that.
No, an itinerant library. No.
Because they traveled the Romans. So.
Oh, yeah, and they knew that they could get books. They would order them from Alexandria. Or they would send people to Alexandria to copy books that they knew were in Alexandria, Egypt, and bring back the copies to Rome. Extremely interesting history.
But everything that one knew, culture, was held in these books, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
It was, I mean, oral tradition very well.
Absolutely. I mean, the histories, all Thucydides, Herodotus, all those guys, this is all in Greek manuscripts.
So there's no concept in Latin for a pocket library or anything like that?
Pocket library. No, what are you going to say? No, portatilis, biblioteca portatilis. Well, now you can have the whole library on a disc in your back pocket.
Well, yes, that's...
That didn't exist, but biblioteca portatilis.
Compact disc.
Yeah, compactus. Discus compactus. That's all Latin. Everyone knows that.
Mm.
Because compingo means to jam together, to squeeze together. So compactus means having been squeezed together. That's all that compact means.
So they're compact discs that have been compacted together, compingo.
And the thing, like in the office, we have all the works of the fathers. It's incredible.
There's nothing like a penguin pocket library.
For the Romans, no. Now, yes, Romans, no.
If they'd had a penguin pocket library, what animal would they have chosen for it?
Pinguini, they didn't know penguins at all. Maybe a pelican, I don't know what.
So a pelican pocket library.
Yeah, that would be more.
Which exists, actually, a pelican.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, certainly.
And you were listening there to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who spent most of his life as papal Latinist. Finally, why not end on a musical note as we listen to a comment on the fourth joyful mystery of the Rosary. That's with Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
Mary and Joseph came to the temple to present the child Jesus to the Lord, as the law required. The presentation in the temple is the fourth joyful mystery of the Rosary. We celebrate it liturgically 40 days after Christmas on the Feast of Candlemas, when we process with lighted candles, bearing witness before the world to the light of Christ. In fact, Simeon describes Jesus as lumen ad revelationem gentium, a light to enlighten the Gentiles.
Lumen ad revelationem gentium, et gloriam plebis tuae Israel.
For our musical meditation today, I'd like to focus on the figure of Simeon. He is presented to us as an old man, devout and upright, faithful to the traditions of Israel. He's one of those pivotal figures between the Old and New Testaments. For most of his life, he was waiting for the Messiah to come. But at the end of his life, he had the privilege of seeing for himself the one who would bring salvation to his people. Senex puerum portabat, the old man carried the child, yet the child was the old man's king. Setting of the Magnificat antiphon for First Vespers on the Feast of the Presentation was composed by William Byrd, a Catholic composer in the reign of Elizabeth I. It's included in a large collection of music that he wrote for use in Catholic worship behind closed doors in the homes of the aristocracy, because Catholic worship in England at that time was strictly against the law of the land. William Byrd enjoyed special favour with Queen Elizabeth, who knew a good composer when she heard one. Although he was a Catholic, he was employed to write music for the Chapel Royal for much of his life. Not only did the Queen apparently not mind him being a Catholic, but there is evidence that she privately paid him an allowance to help him meet the cost of the fines he incurred as a result. He returned the compliment by composing the most glorious music for the liturgy of the Chapel Royal. Listening to the Nunc Dimittis from Byrd's Great Service. Lord, now lettest thou thy servant depart in peace according to thy word. This is the third of the great gospel canticles that form part of the daily liturgy of the hours, and St. Luke places it on the lips of Simeon during the scene of the presentation of the Lord in the temple. It's a marvellous prayer. Simeon acknowledges the privilege he has been given, and he speaks prophetically of the light that Jesus will bring to all the nations of the world. To finish with a more modern setting of the Nunc Dimittis. It was written by Gustav Holst for the choir of Westminster Cathedral in 1915. Listen to the energy of those repeated phrases, Lumen ad Revelationem Gentium, and the exaltation of the concluding Et Gloriam Plebis Tuae Israel. With joy let us contemplate the infant Jesus, who is indeed the light to enlighten the Gentiles, and the glory of his people Israel.
Many thanks there go to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who is currently working as an official at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Laudetur Jesus Christus.